You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
We are going to talk about land reform, but not so much framing the divisive debate that we have seen over the last couple of weeks. I would like to enable you to understand some of the language, some of the issues, and then once we have the same baseline knowledge and understanding of technical terms, such as expropriation, for example, restitution, what does the state's own land audit tell us, what can and can't we learn from case studies such as the Venezuela one. Once you and I have the same baseline knowledge in terms of what the law says, what has been policy since 1994, then you're entitled to have a reflective opinion. And to your credit, and I feel similarly in some respects about certain aspects of this debate, you have written to us and said, listen, Eusebius, can someone just explain what the heck is going on? And that's exactly why we have asked Professor Ruth Hall, who's been on the show before, to be in conversation with us until 11 o'clock. So I want you to call in. There's no such thing as a dumb question. Ask whatever question that you want. If there are bits of debate that are sparked, of course, this is the Eusebius McKaiser show. We will pursue them. But my vision for this hour is that we learn as much as we can from an expert who spends an enormous amount of time trying to make sure that she intervenes academically and in the public space in an evidence-sensitive manner, which you and I don't always do, because it's okay not to be experts on every single topic, including topics that we are emotional about and topics that are important politically and even in terms of our identities. So now is your chance to ask whatever question that you have on this matter and clear up any confusions you have, curiosities you've had. 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg and in Cape Town, 021-446-0567. Ruth, of course, is with the Institute for Poverty, Land and Agrarian Studies, and they do stunning work in our country at the University of the Western Cape. Ruth, thank you so much for coming on the show again. It's always a pleasure having you on.
Thanks so much, Eusebius.
I think let's just take the basics and the conversation will unravel, I suspect, just on its own. When we talk about land reform, those two words that can rile people up as much as white and black and, you know, other words that tend to get our bloods boil as South African, what does land reform even refer to?
Well, land reforms, typically across history, land reforms have typically been embarked on at times of major political change. And the ideas of land reforms typically have been to change the relationships between those who own and don't own property. And so there have been different kinds of land reforms. And we can talk about how, in fact, South Africa's land reform is a very unusual one because it's been so market friendly. But land reforms typically take one of two kinds. Either there are redistributive land reforms. So we say, okay, we have a major problem with inequality between those who own property and those who don't, and we want to reduce inequality. So we have a program of redistributing land. A second type of land reform is where you say the problem is not so much the distribution, but it's the question of what types of rights people have to property. So, for instance, across most of Africa, only about 10% of agricultural land is privately titled. Typically, people hold land under forms of customary tenure. And so there have been lots of tenure reforms across Africa to provide legal recognition and security so that the people who occupy the land are recognized as having clear rights over that land. And of course, in South Africa, we have both of these issues. We have the issue that there's massive inequality. It's marked primarily by race between those who have access to land and those who don't. So we have this division between what used to, under the apartheid government, called white RSA, you know, the commercial farmland areas. And then we also have the former Bantustans or communal areas, the 10 areas that were designated for black occupation and which effectively became the dumping grounds. Now, people across those areas don't have sufficiently clear and secure rights to land. There are also other categories of people in South Africa who have very insecure rights to land, like farm workers, people living in informal settlements. You know, so in South Africa, we have to do both. We have to redistribute and we have to secure tenure rights of non-owners.
Okay, that already is some fantastic and interesting complexity. So when we talk about land reform, you're already entering very difficult discussion because it's an umbrella term that seems to refer to a range of policies with different, albeit complementary, aims.
Yes, absolutely. So in the early 1990s, when the discussion centered on what we're going to do about land reform in South Africa, there were some people who said, well, the solution is simply we nationalize everything.
Yeah.
That resolves certain problems. It doesn't resolve most problems. In fact, it would have given the state enormous power to decide on the reallocation of land. But even where the state owns property, we know that there is still the question of what are the tenure rights of the people who access it, and also how does it allocate it. So I think, you know, that we have enormous opportunity to resolve these issues, and we have more than two decades of experience. And even our missteps on land reform have yielded some very clear lessons that I think are very, very well summarized in this report that was released by the parliamentary high-level panel chaired by former President Galemo Motlanthe that reported in November last year. Unfortunately, the report was released on the day that Mugabe resigned, and you know, the whole it's the most spectacular summary of everything that we know about, firstly, what's been done, how it's gone, what the results have been, who's benefited, and what should we be doing differently.
So let's talk firstly about land restitution, because one of the difficulties that come up in this debate all the time, Maseo Lekota has raised part of the legal difficulties. He's been vilified politically. It doesn't help that he says weird historical things in between interesting things, is of course this question of whose land do we take and who is entitled to be given land back. And it seems to me that land restitution, as one of the pillars of land reform, is perhaps an easier starting point in talking about the different aspects of land reform. Because as I understand it, and I want you to sort of take the baton from here, Ruth, correct me if I'm wrong, but also flesh it out for us, is that land restitution is an attempt in particular to try and reverse the impact of colonial and apartheid laws that deliberately removed people from land that they were occupied. And if we can identify those with some reference to the historic record, then at least there we can begin to be consistent both with what history demands of us morally, but also with the precepts of the Constitution.
Okay, great question. Thanks, Eusebius. Before I start in on restitution, I want to just make a point that I think is not always obvious in these debates, which is that the idea of land reform in the moment of political transition was centered on how are we going to embark on a massive redivision of land in South Africa, a massive process of redistribution, either through nationalizing land or embarking on something really quite large scale, dramatic and quick. And it was as the political transition unfolded and it became clear that nationalization was off the agenda, any kind of radical and rapid redistribution was off the agenda, that groups of people said, well, you know, we don't want to just be part of a general queue of people waiting for land. We were forcibly removed in the course of the creation of the Bantustans. You know, there were people who within living memory and even into the mid-80s had been trying to resist removals. And they said, we don't have a general demand for land. We just want a right to return to our own particular land. And so it was only really by about 1993 that there was a decision taken that there should be a special provision for those who were dispossessed relatively recently to return to the specific land from which they were removed. And in fact, when that idea emerged, it was by no means clear that it would stretch back as far as 1913. And in fact, one of the dates that was suggested was 1948. Then people said, well, why aren't we talking about 1652? And so eventually this compromise was reached of 1913. And the problem with the 1913 cutoff date, which of course is the date of the Natives Land Act. So that means anyone whose family was or community was dispossessed unfairly because of apartheid after the date of the 1913 Land Act was entitled to claim back that property or to get some kind of compensation in cash or alternative land. Now, the problem with that, firstly, which has been well articulated by so many South Africans, especially the Khoisan community, is that, well, you know, most of South Africa was dispossessed prior to 1913.
That's right.
And in many ways, the 1913 Natives Land Act was about consolidating and confirming that dispossession and setting aside native reserves. So, you know, it assists some people, but many people are left outside of the restitution fold.
That's right. That's right. But nevertheless, it was, I suppose, an attempt to have some early wins in terms of how we deal with this thing. And I'm not sure how much one could anticipate some of the difficult questions that would arise later, like why 1913? Why not going way, back into history, for example? So insofar as restitution then was meant to actually commence in 1994, the Restitution of Land Rights Act, for example, was passed to much applause in 1994. What did it actually set out to achieve, Ruth? And more importantly, how did the ANC-led government get on with then complying with its own legislation?
Okay, so those are two distinct questions. On the first one, what did it set out to do? I think that restitution is somewhat different from the rest of land reform, because restitution is, of course, not only about land. It's about providing a redress for a specific historical grievance. So in many ways, it's more linked to the issue of transitional justice, reconciliation. There's meant to be a process of redress. But at the same time, of course, it's meant to provide a tangible benefit economically in terms of transferring assets and reducing inequality and poverty. Mm. So, and these don't always work very well. You know, there was a great study that was conducted some time ago after one of the first restitution claims was resolved, and an old woman was interviewed. This was in KZN at Ikopo, and she was asked, "Now that you've got your land back, has justice been achieved?" And she said, "Yes, but justice alone is not something you can eat."
Yeah.
And I thought that was an amazing way of putting together this idea that you can get justice, but it doesn't lead directly to development. And, of course, that's been one of the big issues, that often large communities of people who actually don't know each other, you know, if communities were dispossessed in the 1930s, it's not like they all live together and know each other.
That's right.
They've been dispersed around the country. So you're reconstituting communities who often are in different positions with different priorities, education, wealth. Some want to return. Others want to get some kind of income stream. You know, they would rather rent it out and get some kind of income, while others desperately need a place to live and to create a livelihood from scratch. And so it's not surprising that there's been a lot of conflict and unclarity about how land is to be used. Hmm. And of course, there's also a question of what exactly does restitution consist of? Is it just giving the land back? Or does restitution, you know, in international law, the idea of restitution is to restore somebody to the position that they would have been had they not been dispossessed. And that's very different.
That's very difficult to determine.
Yes. And well, it means that you need to not stop at the transfer of land. It means that you need to invest massively in development, that restitution involves development. And I think that's where we have a difficulty, because we have a commission on the restitution of land rights, and their mandate is to restore land.
So how much of this land was transferred?
How much land? I haven't got the figure in front of me, but together restitution and redistribution have transferred about 8% of former commercial farmland. It's a little bit more under redistribution. So something like, I think, 3.5 million hectares have been restored through restitution. Of course, the one of the issues is that communities have to create new institutions to hold their land together. That is a complicated process. They often enter into joint ventures with commercial companies. There's a lot of experience of that, particularly in the sort of high-value sectors of agriculture. So, for instance, in the timber industry, the big companies, say in Mpumalanga, parts of Limpopo, are saying, listen, we're very happy to sell off the land. You can restore it to the communities just as long as it remains somewhat under our control, because we own the mills.
Yeah.
So we want to ensure that there's going to be continued supply for our mills. So there are a whole lot of different practices. If you want to know where we're at with restitution, I think that many people feel that restitution is my best chance at land reform. And of course, this was promoted as an idea when just ahead of the national elections in 2014, government announced that there would be a reopening of the opportunity for people to put in their claims, because many people didn't get round to it in the first wave in the 1990s, or they weren't aware of it, or they didn't trust the process.
Sure.
And so there was a reopening, and now there's been an enormous number of new claims. In fact, in the first wave, there were around 63,000 claims, and already since 1994, the new claims are well over double that. So we've got more than 160,000 new claims. And given the pace at which we're settling claims on average, it's going to take another 35 years just to resolve the old claims that are still left over from 1998. And even if there are no more new claims in the next couple of years, which is unlikely, there will be, the new claims that have already been submitted at the current pace of settling claims, we estimate will take 143 years after that 35 years.
Wow, that is spectacular.
We're looking at just about the end of the next century. So I think that, you know, a political promise was made in 2014 that was rash and ill-informed, and is going to be a real challenge for any government to deal with, because expectations obviously have been raised.
Absolutely, absolutely. And especially now, it's going to be a hit of a topic, this, going into the election cycle. It's 20 minutes after 10. We're going to take a break. You are listening to the familiar voice of Professor Ruth Hall. And this is, I don't know, you can think of it as Land Reform 101. You would have heard Ruth there distinguishing between restitution and redistribution. That raises the obvious question, what is the difference? And the other thing I want to ask her on the other side of this first commercial break is this willing buyer, willing seller policy. What is it? How is it meant to work? And can we evaluate its success that the government was hoping that it would actually be? And any questions you have about land reform, like I said, there's no such thing as a dumb question. This hour is for you to get up to speed factually, to understand the complicated terminology, so that you can be empowered to then have an informed viewpoint on what will be one of the most important issues for at least the next year, particularly as we go into the election cycle.
Eusebius McKaiser on your number one news and talk station.
Okay, Ruth, I think I heard you there mentioning restitution differently to redistribution. Was that right? Did I hear correctly? And what's the difference?
So the redistribution of land refers to a process where the state can either get land and allocate it to people or assist people to buy it themselves. So that is actually a process that's available to any South African. What the Constitution says is that the state must take reasonable legislative and other measures to provide citizens with access to land on an equitable basis.
Okay.
So it means that people can express a demand for land, whether it be urban or rural land, to the state, and the state needs to have a process to respond to that. So effectively, the redistribution program is where you don't need to show that you have any historical link to the land. You don't need to show, oh, my granny was dispossessed, this is why I'm claiming the land. You can simply say, I have a need for land, and the state needs to respond. Whereas restitution is about having to prove a historical link. And one of the differences that I think is very important to bear in mind is that restitution is therefore slower and more expensive than redistribution, because there has to be investigation into the history, there has to be archival research, there has to be often anthropologists and historians involved, there needs to be evidence to prove the validity of a claim, and then you have to trace family trees, family members, get affidavits, powers of attorney. It's a highly cumbersome process, whereas with redistribution, you can express a demand for land, the state can respond to it. The question is, how has the state actually used these powers? So I think that a lot of people have felt so frustrated with the redistribution process that they feel the only way to force the issue is to put in land claims for restitution.
Okay. We've got lots of people who want to ask questions. Let me not hog the mic. David, good morning to you.
Hi, Eusebius. How are you doing?
Extremely well. What question do you have, David?
Eusebius, just with regards to the land audit that was done last year and these percentages that are coming out now about land ownership in South Africa, has it been factored into the percentages, those claims that were settled in cash versus those claims that were taken as land?
Good question, David. And when we talk about the land audit in a little bit, we will ask how that was calculated. I love that question. Lawrence, good morning to you. Okay, we've lost Lawrence there. Bandile, good morning.
Hi, good morning, ECVS. And good morning, Ruth. My question is around what implications there are for urban land in this question of land expropriation without compensation. So a lot of the focus has been on, you know, farmers and agricultural land and this sort of thing. But what about urban land is brought out by this whole discussion?
Okay. I mean, these questions are lovely. They all anticipate other themes we're going to get to in the second half of the hour, Ruth. I just want to stick for the moment on the question around willing buyer, willing seller. Was that an attempt to then help expedite redistribution of land? Where does willing buyer, willing seller come in, the much aligned policy?
Yes, this much maligned policy of willing buyer, willing seller was introduced as an idea by the World Bank, which sent a mission to South Africa in 1993 to work with the ANC to develop a policy framework for both land reform and agriculture. So the World Bank sent a bunch of economists over. They worked with the ANC, set up a joint research institute, worked with a whole lot of academics, and developed what they called some options for rural restructuring. And what the bank suggested was you should be promoting black smallholder agriculture, but you must do so by embarking on a market-based land reform. They said the market is efficient and will help us to redistribute lots of land quickly and effectively. And you then deregulate agriculture and remove subsidies that have been provided to white farmers. I'm giving a very garbled brief summary, but that is essentially the key features of the World Bank proposals. And if we look at what happened during the 1990s, the ANC largely followed these proposals. It embarked on a market-based land reform, and that means that even though the government has powers under the property clause in the Constitution to expropriate land for land reform purposes, to take it by force, in other words, it has decided not to use those powers. So the willing buyer, willing seller approach is not in the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't require that. Willing buyer, willing seller means we will only purchase from those who are willing to sell. So it means that if, for instance, you have a land claim on a farm by people who were dispossessed in the 1970s, now there is a current owner, the state goes off and says, there's a claim on your land. Would you like to sell? We can offer you this amount of money. Yeah. And they often are estimating a market value. And if the owner says no, then that claim cannot proceed. So, you know, the problem here is that we have a property clause that does not provide a blanket protection for existing property rights. In fact, it says the state must embark on restitution. That's right. But in practice, because of this willing buyer, willing seller approach, which is we will not force property owners who don't want to sell or who don't want to give up their land, it means that effectively landowners have had a veto on the land reform process.
Okay, we're going to come back to the logic behind willing buyer, willing seller, given that there's more legal flexibility in Section 25 than what the ANC has been prepared to test in court even.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Ruth, this brings us to something I certainly do have a view on, I must say, as a fan of our Constitution, unapologetically. I love how you have described that, in fact, the origins of willing buyer, willing seller is Bretton Woods institutions, not the Constitution. It also raises this question in terms of if one were to look at Section 25, what it does say about the market value of property needing to be taken into account when it comes to compensation. But a lot has been misunderstood here, hasn't it? Because firstly, under the five or six factors that are enumerated as the ones that must be taken into account, those are all factors that are in service of the overarching phrase, just and equitable compensation. So not even Section 25 says that market value is compulsory to pay out. It's the ANC that hasn't been ballsy enough to test the meaning of Section 25 maximally.
Absolutely. That's correct. And of course, the two things that the state has chosen not to do is firstly to take property by force through expropriation for land reform purposes. And secondly, to offer compensation, either to offer no compensation or compensation that is not market value. Yeah. So it's actually Section 25(3) of the Constitution, which says compensation must be just and equitable, reflecting an equitable balance between the public interest, and of course, partly the public interest is not to, is, you know, we have a fiscal problem in this
as
country.
We know. Yeah.
So, reflecting an equitable balance between the public interest and the interests of those affected, including A, the current use of the property, B, so for instance, underutilized land might be approached differently, B, the history of the acquisition and use of the property, C, the market value of the property, D, and this is an interesting one, the extent of direct state investment and subsidy in the acquisition and beneficial capital improvement of the property. In other words, if you were a white commercial farmer and you benefited for years from massive state subsidies, including subsidized interest rates and debt write-offs under the Agricultural Credit Board and the Land Bank, then why would we pay you out for the benefit of that?
Let alone, let alone market value.
Yes, and then the fifth one is interesting because, you know, it's hard to put a number on, but the fifth factor that must be taken into account when determining what is just and equitable in terms of compensation is the purpose of the expropriation.
That's right.
So this is these are the provisions that the state hasn't used. And I'm sure, as you know, Advocate Tembeka Nkaitobi has been very vocal in saying, you know, we cannot move ahead with an expropriation-based land reform without looking at let's test this, you know. Let's test it and use it. And there have been test cases that could have tested this. And, you know, when I think about the motion that was passed in Parliament 3 weeks ago now, on the 27th of February, calling for a process to look into amending the property clause, what I wonder is, do we want a system that is a blanket approach of no compensation for anyone, you know, or do we want something that is just and equitable? And if we want something that is just and equitable, we would need to say what is wrong with this section.
And Section 25(3) has got more clauses than the third one. The other one that is routinely left out, and it doesn't help that the ANC has been very keen to pay market value, even when it had the chance to test cases otherwise, Ruth, is Section 25(8). I don't know when last you looked at it, but it is even more, I think, expansive in what it enables the state potentially to lawfully do. It reads as follows. No provision of this section may impede the state from taking legislative and other measures to achieve land, water, and related reform in order to redress the results of past racial discrimination, provided that any departure from the provisions of this section is in accordance with the provisions of Section 36, the limitations. So, you know, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. It raises an interesting, partly speculative question. You would know it more than speculatively, but also on the basis of observing the state. Why has the ANC government been so coy? And now we're putting the Constitution on trial.
Yes, I agree that that's exactly what's happened. Yeah, the Section 25(8) is, we call it the override clause. So even though there's a provision at the start of the property clause that says no one may be deprived of law except, you know, through a law of general application. That's the only protection for property owners in the Constitution, that if you're deprived of property, it should be through a non-discriminatory law. So it says no provision can stop the state from taking measures to achieve reforms that help to deal with the results of past racial discrimination. Why has the state refused to do this? Well, I think that there are a few reasons. One is, firstly, I think that land reform has never been a political priority since the 1990s. We see that in the allocation of budgets. It's never got more than 1% of the national budget. Secondly, of course, we know that from the mid-1990s, the so-called 96 class project, that the shift towards gear, towards making South Africa investor-friendly, building, making assurances around the nature of property rights as a basis for attracting investment, has been absolutely key. That was key to Thabo Mbeki's period. And in fact, despite the rhetoric of radical economic transformation in the Zuma period, the Zuma government did everything it could to shore up private property rights, and in fact actively opposed in attempts by, for instance, labor tenants in KwaZulu-Natal to get their own land. And that case is currently still in court, where the state is opposing small black farmers' claims to become the owners of the land that they already occupy and use. So I think that we need to read through some of the smoke, you know, but we need to see beyond the smoke and mirrors on this issue. Up to now, the ANC has decided, to the extent that it will confront vested interests to drive economic transformation, it is not around the issue of land. So here we have an irony that in the Zuma years, with the rhetoric of radical economic transformation, we've actually seen the rolling down of the land reform program. You know, there was a graph that was based on the high-level report that appeared in the Mail and Guardian a couple of weeks ago, and it shows the high point of land reform being in 2008, and basically the program has come almost to a standstill in the past year. It is going extremely slowly. And yet, ironically, the new president, Cyril Ramaphosa, who is often seen as being quite friendly towards business interests, has come in, and one of his first actions is to usher in this move towards expropriation without compensation. And I think that we are in a new era now, not necessarily because the president is wedded to expropriation without compensation, but because the political moment has forced his hand.
Well, what's interesting, though, is that he's dithering, because he says that he's supporting expropriation without compensation, mindful of what's happening on the left or the right, depending on how you characterize the EFF, and they're worried about what the political consequences will be of the EFF successfully transforming that rhetoric into votes, Ruth. But, of course, they don't say expropriation without compensation, full stop. They then put bells and whistles on, which Malema has rightly pointed out, means that they are qualifying it in ways that suggest that it really isn't expropriation without compensation in the sense in which the EFF imagines. And I've had this discussion with advocate Tembeka and Ngukai Tobi, and I asked him what would be jurisprudentially and administratively the advantages, if any, of simpler language than Section 25, notwithstanding our agreement, most of us, that Section 25 is sufficiently radical if only the ANC was gutsy enough to actually use it. And Tembeka was saying one advantage with simple language is that it makes it easier, or harder rather, for those people entrusted to enact the policies to be able to get away with fudging the matter. What do you make of notwithstanding what the Constitution says, Ruth, having a clear act of Parliament that talks about expropriation without compensation, and we are clear that it means you don't pay any money, or you will definitely pay a nominal amount that is less than market value. Do you think that will be helpful in clarifying the matters rather than us resorting to complex hermeneutical debates about Section 25?
Well, listen, I think that we need to ask two questions. One is, why expropriation without compensation? What problem would it solve? And secondly, we need to say expropriation without compensation where, in which circumstances, and where not, you know? And I think that here we have to be clear that we're going to have one legal framework for all South Africans. So, you know, the same way that a large corporate landowner that holds multiple farms that are under claim, that landowner must be treated with the same set of principles, not in the same way, but with the same set of principles as a community at Polokwane in the former Transkei, who are being threatened with dispossession to make way for titanium mining.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we need to have a set of principles that are not discriminatory, but allow us to have a varied approach in the interests of, I would argue, still justice and equity. So my view is that the value of expropriation, expropriation is where you need to drive ahead a process without being reliant on the willingness of landowners. That's about breaking a deadlock.
Okay.
The issue of compensation, whether to pay compensation, is actually a separate issue from expropriation. The question of whether or not to pay compensation has rests on two principles. One is the argument, is a moral and political argument, which is it is wrong to pay out, you know, and that is the EFF's view. This is stolen property. We must not pay out. what they never point out is that expropriation will include expropriation of poor people's property, for instance, for public purposes. And we can't have a blanket approach, is my view. So I think that we're into a situation where we need to say, what are the kinds of situations? We need to have a policy that says, what are the kinds of situations where there shouldn't be compensation?
Yeah.
And here, of course, the public call is that people don't want white people to benefit unduly again from apartheid. So I think that I actually have a suggestion that there are three kinds of situations where there might be a very good argument to start with expropriation without compensation. And they're all situations where poor black people, because of our kind of history, don't have secure rights to the land that they're on, but they're actually tenants of other property owners. And the one is, and the key one, I think, that should be looked at is labor tenants in KwaZulu-Natal, who for decades and generations have lived on white-owned land, but they're actually black small-scale farmers. When we talk about the class of the black peasantry that was wiped off the land by the 1913 Natives Land Act, well, these are the people who managed to hang on. And under existing law, the private property owners on whose land they live don't actually have rights to use that land. So, in fact, that land doesn't even have, I would argue, a market value at all. So upgrading the rights of tenants would be a very good example. Another example, and I would agree with, I think it was Bandile who talked about urban land, and I think this is crucial.
That's right.
I think it's also strategically crucial for the ANC because when the EFF talks about land, they talk about it as sort of symbol of dispossession and citizenship and identity, but then not particularly around interested in agricultural land, and their political base is very urban. So I think that actually there are two situations in an urban context where one could look at expropriation without compensation. The two prime ones would be informal settlements where people are occupying land owned either by state entities or private owners.
Yeah.
And they live there because they have no other place to go.
That's right.
Instead of criminalizing occupation of land, rather using expropriation without compensation and upgrading people's rights and regularizing that. And the other is this issue of inner city abandoned buildings. So I think that, you know, there are some places to start and that the onus is now very much on well, I suppose all South Africans, all political parties, but particularly on the government to come forward with a policy proposal.
Let's take a break there, Ruth, as I expected. Huge interest in this topic. Unfortunately, we only have 12 minutes left and we have at least 20 questions from the public for you. We'll see how many of those we can feed through on the other side of this.
Eusebius Makaiser on your number one news and talk station.
Sean, good morning. What is your question?
Hello, Isubas. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Yeah, I think last time I called you and I told you that my family owns land in Limpopo. So now my problem is one, the illusion that black people don't own land. I can tell you now that black people in rural areas, we own ancestors' land, and no king can dictate as to what happens to that land. So now, if the state takes our land, can we take action against them if they want to take our land, as the EFF is saying?
Very good question, Ruth. Many of my listeners have been wanting to know, will any kind of any new laws or policies, will it be framed in racial terms? If you are like Sean's family, a black family, and you have land, will you be excluded? And would it even be constitutional to have not a law of general application, but effectively a law targeting whites?
It would be unconstitutional to have a law that that is racially defined. So whatever approach we take must be one that can be applied across the board. I mean, I think that actually the EFF didn't anticipate that there are many black property owners who've been very upset by this discussion of expropriation without compensation and saying, you know, we bought our own land, we have saved for this, we have invested in our land. But of course, you know, that's where I think the EFF skirts the real issues. And that's why, you know, you were talking about sort of, are they left? Are they right? There's a form of populism, which is actually avoiding some of the hard questions.
Yeah.
Hard questions are not just how we get the land, because of course that's good at mobilizing.
Yes.
But the core questions are about, well, who should get the land and what land do they need and what for? And that's why I would actually argue that, although I think that the issue of expropriation without compensation has not, that the absence of that has not been the problem with land reform. Firstly, we should have had expropriation, whether with or without. But the problems facing land reform have been, there's been no policy direction, there's been no clear leadership, there's been no political impetus or budget, and very weak institutional capacity. Plus, there's been corruption and mismanagement and elite capture. You know, all of this is very well documented now in the high-level panel. But I think that, you know, what Sean said, I think it was Sean, he said no king can dictate. And this, of course, brings us to the thorny issue of communal areas, traditional authority, and Ingonyama Trust. So I think that it's interesting that at the same time that we're discussing expropriation without compensation as if it will only apply to white farmers, of course, you know, it'll have more general application. There has been this uprising of voices from KZN where people are saying the Ingonyama Trust is turning us from owners into tenants and making us sign leases and pay rent to the trust, and the only trustee of the Ingonyama Trust is the king. And none of that money can be audited. The Auditor General cannot manage to audit those accounts. So, you know, so there we have actually poor black people in KZN being expropriated without compensation by the king, by the Ingonyama Trust. So, you know, it really shows that we need to be looking at these things not as if we're going to have different laws and for different types of people. We are one country. But what I would say is that, and this is where I think we need to start to weave together our thinking about agricultural land, urban land, that land reform is about overcoming spatial inequality and spatial apartheid. So I would hope that we can move away from equating land reform only with agriculture, and certainly not only with commercial agriculture, which of course is beyond the reach of most people and not what people need and want in their lives.
Yeah.
But I think that it is a mandate that should cross-cut government. Municipalities should be doing land reform. Metros should be thinking in land reform terms. It is about overcoming spatial apartheid.
Ruth, we've only got 3 minutes left, so let's keep this one very short. I'm going to beg your presence again in a future show. You've been stunning so far. Let's give some quick wins on 3 very quick questions. Quinton, I'm going to give you one question. What is your question? And apologies you had to wait so long, but many people have been in the queue.
Look, I am a white commercial farmer. I have a couple of things to state, actually. Firstly, I think the uncertainty being caused by this announcement is causing farming to stand still. No one's buying property. As a white farmer now, we don't know. Is it foreigners, foreign landowners? Is it people that own more than one property? Is it absent landlords? So no one's taking the risk now to buy a farm. So farm dealing is standing still. In my area, 2 farms have already fallen through that were in the final throes of, okay. Then the thing that I just want to say is I think that this uncertainty and should there be the first case of land expropriation without compensation needs to be very, very, very carefully reviewed, because land value is the basis on which we produce crops as commercial farmers.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. That's just a comment. You can't do it in 1 minute, Ruth, but I'm going to ask the questions anyway. Does the state finally know factually how much land it has under its control? And where does Venezuela fit in here? Does it help the case of the EFF or not? It tends to come up in these debates.
Okay. The state does not know exactly what land it owns. In fact, the state land audit had enormous gaps. They couldn't locate, for instance, 24% of the Eastern Cape was unaccounted for. Even the land audit of private ownership only refers to 39% of the land, because a lot of land is owned by companies and trusts, and it can only trace individuals. So, yeah,
what?
We have a very
wow.
We have a poor understanding of who owns what. The state knows what major state entities own, but it doesn't know about municipalities and parastatals, which are very big landowners. So, yeah, we don't have a good big picture. Venezuela is, in a sense, Latin America's Zimbabwe, in that it bucked international development agencies and the international financial institutions and said, we are going to override property rights. We will expropriate properties. The focus there was on people who couldn't trace, on the big landowners, who couldn't trace very long history of ownership. It also protected squatters' rights. So it said no to market-based land reform. I think that we have an opportunity to do something slightly different and better than the Venezuelan option, because I think that we have records of who wants land where, who has claimed land where. We have the capacity to go for a slightly more planned and targeted approach. I think that, you know, there's no point in just willy-nilly expropriating. I think that the problem with expropriation is that it only tells you how to get the land. The problem is we don't know, we're focusing on supply rather than demand. And I think we need to shift the whole land debate back to the question of who wants and needs land for what, and start to take seriously the argument about equitable access in the Constitution, the mandate for redistribution. And equitable access suggests that you must start and prioritize. You must start with the needs of those in greatest need. You can't just be acquiring a land, giving a farm to a friend. We need to have a system that says we will prioritize those in greatest need, whether in urban or rural areas, and have a planned approach and override the market where needed and get this done. So I think we should focus a little bit less on the mechanisms and more on the big vision.
Ruth, you've been stunning. Many teaching moments there over the last hour. Thank you so much.
It was a great pleasure.